This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, as well as 90.9 FM HD 2 and 3, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. On the program today, Computers and You. This is a topic we take up once a month, usually on the third Monday of the month. Peter Kimball is our guest. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. So this afternoon, your questions, listeners, are invited about computers for Peter Kimball. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number if you're listening outside the local dialing area, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Good to see you, Peter. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back. I was surprised to see the little snow flurries.
Yeah, how about that?
It's that time of year, I guess.
It sure is. Well, we're not far out from Thanksgiving, and I saw holiday displays this weekend at the store and reminders it's like only 6 weeks away.
Yes, and just to tie it into the theme of the program, some of those holiday displays, the lighting displays are now more and more computerized. I'm not sure that that's good news if your neighbor installs a intricate, flashy sort of display.
It can be fun to drive past, but yeah, living next door, another question.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, what do you say we talk a little bit about what might be coming down the pike? Speaking of the future here, you suggested maybe we talk about some of the things that might be the next big thing.
Well, that's true. This is the time of year that a lot of predictions get made about the next big thing, what's likely to change your life forever, or perhaps at least make things a little bit simpler. And one of them in the area of technology is actually, sounds a little bit funny, it's a device called a memristor. That's kind of a combination between memory and resistor. And it's an electronic device that could be used in computers for memory. Problem currently is that computers in general don't recall information when they're turned off unless they're stored in relatively expensive, relatively being the keyword, static RAM like things like the little keychain smart drives and things that you can have, or on the memory cards and cameras and such. But those are still relatively expensive. This is new technology that is actually well on its way to being implemented. It can start appearing within the next year or two, and it's going to be presumably so cheap that many predictions are that within 3 or 4 years there will be computers using this technology for hard drives. Unlike the hard drives you can get today, there are some, Apple makes a couple and Dell makes some, especially for laptops that don't have any moving parts. It's all electronic, so you have a number of advantages, but they're fairly expensive compared to standard hard drives. These should be much cheaper, and so they may be the wave of the future and they're very small, so they could have an iPod-sized device or an iPhone-sized device or almost any MP3 player or smart cell phone device that could still fit in your pocket and would have more computing power and more memory than the desktop PC does now.
Really?
And this could well be coming down the pike within it's going to start appearing, they suspect, in laptops by 2012, which is not that far away. And by 2014, more desktop-based machines will probably use this technology. They'll get cheaper. More reliable. They'll pretty much be instant on because no hard drive necessary. Much more reliable.
Okay, and so it will remember where we left off?
Yes, it can remember all of that. There are computers today that can do that. If you have the memory that is able to store the exact state of the computer without having to record it onto a hard drive, that can be restored as soon as power is turned back on. And instead of taking maybe 10, 15 seconds or maybe a minute or two for things to boot up and come back, it can come back within just a matter of seconds. It's sort of like many laptops have a hibernation mode in which they can go to sleep and then you can wake them up and you're back to whatever you were doing before. But now imagine that same sort of thing, but that only taking just a second or two to go into or come out of hibernation mode.
Interesting.
So that should be coming along.
Okay. What else is on the horizon?
Well, Everything gets faster and everything gets smaller. Back in the early days, so 29 or 30 years ago when Intel first released the chip that was used in the IBM PC, it's a computer on a chip. It's called a CPU. And they kept getting faster and faster. And for a while, companies such as Intel and one of its major competitors, AMD, were in a war of speeds. They said, our chip is better because it runs at so many thousands or millions or billions of operations per second. And then they began to realize that just raw speed wasn't really the most effective measurement of how much work you could get done. What turns out to be much more effective is if you could build two separate computing units on the same chip, what ended up being called a dual-core processor. Because then if the software is written correctly, that would be either the operating system like the Mac OS or Windows, as well as the application software, things like email programs or maybe especially things like video processing and photographic programs like Photoshop and such, they could take advantage of having multiple cores, multiple CPUs all built into one, split the job up, and while it wouldn't run twice as fast, it would run significantly faster than just one. The reason it can't run twice as fast is because there's still communication and overhead, and you can't be 100% efficient. Well, that went up to quad cores, so a lot of machines are now quad core, four CPU chips all built into the same. Intel is about to release, and they'll be coming available in high-end machines maybe even by Christmas, because they're scheduled to be released within a day or two, eight-core chips, where there are eight computers built into the same chip. To give a comparison, there is a press release from Intel, the chip about which the whole IBM was built, IBM PC was built, had about 30,000 transistors. We're now up to about 730 million transistors. That's a rough measurement of the complexity and the functionality of the machine, which means it's going to really speed along as soon as software is written, which is already happening, to take advantage of it. So again, that makes the machines all possible to be much smaller, much more powerful. And one phrase that has been used is if you are still using a computer today that has only one core, in other words, it's just one of those basic, not a dual core, not a quad core, people are starting to call those computers kind of like dinosaurs. It's really old and can't take advantage of a lot of the new functionality. That's not going to matter for someone who is just surfing the web as long as they're not going to sites that involve a lot of video and such. If you're just reading relatively static web pages with images, fine. But a lot of websites now have a lot more interaction. They may have flash files. They may have other video files. Those can make a difference. If you're just sending and reading email, it's not going to matter that much. But if you're going to start showing movies or doing multimedia or creating video, which is becoming easier and easier from your home camcorder and sending it off to somebody or putting it up on YouTube or even doing higher quality, then there's definitely advantages to having more power.
Okay. And so some software is already being written?
Yes. A lot of software has been written for the multiple cores because they've been out for several years for the dual core and the quad core. It's anticipated, of course, the everything tends to double because computers are kind of binary devices and powers of two. So we went from one to two to four. What's being released this week, I believe, maybe even today, is eight. There is well underway development of 16 and 32-core processors. The 32-core processor may be out, well, probably within 2010, 2011. It's coming along. There was a fairly famous axiom stated, Moore's Law, that computer systems or processors are going to double their capacity and speed about every year and a half. And when he first promulgated that, it was assumed, well, this would work for a while because eventually it would have to stop working, the common thinking was, because there's just going to be a limit. Well, so far it's held true, even though it's now many years later, the amount of processing and the amount of power and memory and the things they can do is just continuing to increase exponentially, although the exponent is only two, but still, that's still an exponent.
Well, yeah. Well, if you're doubling, too,
yeah.
That's
So it's pretty significant.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. It's our Computers and You show today. Peter Kimball is our guest. He's with the Fast 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. You can join us this afternoon if you've got a question about computers. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, a listener on line 4. Good afternoon.
Here's my problem. It's a laptop. Every time I boot up, I get an error message that says that some file is not working properly, and it's UWICUCI.exe. And it's in the Windows folder, apparently. And let's see, what else can I tell you about it? I do a search, and I find it in the Windows folder. I try to start it, and it says it has to know what program created this file and gives me an option to go online to find out what it is, and I can't find it anywhere. I do a Google search on it. No reference to that file at all.
Yes, and I was just, as you were describing that, doing the same kind of search and found no reference. It was UWICUCI,
right.
Correct?
.exe.
Yeah, .exe, which simply means it's an executable. And there was any indication, you said that it did indicate that it was in a Windows system directory?
Yes.
So it's in the path that it gives you is like C colon backslash Windows or something of
right,
that sort.
Exactly.
When did this start happening? Was this something that just began recently?
Yeah, fairly recently. I'd say within the last month or so.
All right. And when you go ahead and just go past this, do you notice any functional change? Do things still seem to work even though you've got...
It's hard to say. I tell you what, I've been having a number of problems on this computer, and one of the strange ones is that even though I had pop-up blockers, when I used the Mozilla browser, I would still get pop-ups, and I got pretty frustrated with that. I had to just kill it, and I used another browser called Opera.
Right.
And also IE, and I don't get the pop-ups in either of those. But that message itself started happening after I deleted, not Thunderbird, but Firefox. But other than that, and some difficulty installing other programs, like I tried to install Google Chrome, and I can't get it installed.
Okay, well, there are a number of possibilities, and I think probably a number of steps that you can try to follow. I'm going to guess that you have up-to-date antivirus software.
I do. I have Adaware. Spyware Doctor, Firewall, and I think everything else.
Okay. It's still possible that I guess the other question, which you probably would have mentioned if it were applicable, is that as far as you know, you didn't install any new software shortly before this problem happened. It was pretty much just the problem of pop-ups coming in Firefox. You deleted Firefox or uninstalled it, or what did you do?
Uninstalled it, yeah.
Okay. And that was simply through the Windows Ad Remove programs?
Right.
Okay. Well, the first thing I would try to do, in case this is related somehow to a problem with Firefox, is you might want to just try to do a completely brand new install of Firefox. See if that new install behaves itself any better, particularly in terms of all the various block-ups, blocking the pop-ups.
I did try that. And I still
okay.
got pop-ups.
And then you did another uninstall?
Correct.
Okay. Do Do you have, and you haven't installed or uninstalled things for some time other than that then?
I don't think so. I mean, sometimes I go online. Well, I may have tried to install, which was is another question in altogether, a registry checker, thinking that maybe there was something awry there. So it's possible that I might have installed and uninstalled such a thing.
Right. Well, and some registry checkers don't really help you out. I mean, they try, but they get a little bit odd. I'm going to, and I presume you're running Windows XP probably?
Correct, and I have SP3.
Okay, that's fine. I'm going to suggest that what you try to do to, my next step would be to try to go back to an earlier restore point.
Right.
Do you know how to find or get to your restore points?
Yeah, I did that once. I'm trying to remember what problem I was having. And I had to go back about a month.
Well, the good news about the restore points is when you go back to them, they won't delete any documents or undo any documents, but they will undo a lot of changes to the registry that may have been done, to various other system files. And at this point, with all of these things going on, you may well need to go back or want to try going back, picking out an earlier restore point. You may have to do it three or four times. If you've done it before, you're aware of the process. You go back where you think the problem was fixed and restore to that point. Right. And if it works, great. And if not, you can undo the restore or go back even further. And so that is probably going to be the best solution. There may be other problems in there, and since you've tried uninstalling and reinstalling the software, the choice may be, if you can't get it to do a restore to a point that it works, you could always use the ultimate option of saving all your files and reinstalling Windows. That's a real pain, but it certainly...
Ouch.
I know. It cleans everything up. I would definitely go with the restore point option before I even attempted to do that.
Right. Okay.
If it does come to a reinstall, yes, it's painful, but the good news is that you would have a system that would run like new.
Yeah, right.
Without all that extra clutter. But I don't know of what this one missing file is or who created it, and as you say, there's no reference to it on Google, so that's not much help.
Isn't that strange, though, that Google or Microsoft would not have any reference to it?
Well, if it's a file that is of questionable origin, some programs, and I'm not suggesting this, it's just a possibility, some programs that are doing things you'd rather not have done, such as, monitoring programs and spyware programs and such, can sometimes create files and just sort of randomize the name and store it someplace so that it wouldn't be a name that anybody else would necessarily have on their system. I don't think that's the case here, but it's not unheard of that wouldn't exist.
Since it's unidentifiable, do you think I could take a chance on deleting whatever appears in the folder?
Well, I would say, is this in its own subfolder within Windows?
I'm not sure.
You certainly don't want to delete all the, random things in the Windows folder, but if this is in a folder that looks like was closely associated with this file and nothing else, in other words, there aren't a lot of other things in there, I wouldn't delete it. What you can do is rename it and rename the folder so it won't be found. And then should the disaster happen and there was something in there that was needed for Windows to start up, unlikely if it's in a separate folder, you could always start in safe mode and then go back and name it back to its original.
Right.
But deleting it is something you want to hedge your bets with a little bit.
Right. If I can indulge you a little bit longer, I misspoke to some extent because that file name, UWICUCI, appears in two places. One is in, as I said, the Windows/prefetch. And the other is in Documents and Settings, My Name, Local Settings, Application Data.
It's not surprising that it's there. That would show up if, as references, a lot of things it could well be pointed to the same file. The fact that it's in application data simply means it was installed by something, presumably.
Right.
But we still don't really have the information. So I'd go with the restore point.
Right. Okay. Okay, great.
Good luck.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Next, we talk with a listener on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I have a question about software that actually you talk and it types the words for you. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Voice recognition software.
Yeah, and I guess I a while back purchased, I forget what brand it was, and I tried it, and it just did not seem to be very effective. You know, it would get words completely wrong.
Right.
You'd say one word, it would break it up into two or three little small words, and I guess I wondered, it's been 5 or so years since I did that. Have they made any headway in those sorts of things, and is it worth going ahead and spending more? Are there packages you can get that actually work properly, or what do you think?
Well, it has gotten better. There's no question about that. One of the early and still very popular software packages was Dragon Naturally Speaking, and it had a fair amount of criticism when it first came out. It's generally one of the more highly reviewed these days. There's a little bit of voice recognition actually included with Windows Vista.
Okay.
And IBM had, I presume you're running a relatively, are you running on Windows or the Macintosh?
It's Windows.
Okay. And a XP or a Vista system, I presume, as opposed to
XP,
an older one.
Yeah,
okay.
XP.
So they have gotten better. They're certainly not foolproof. They can. Some of the reviews, for example, for Dragon Naturally Speaking, say they can run with a 95% accuracy rate. That's the one that generally gets the best reviews, and it's relatively inexpensive. I don't know if they have a trial version that you can use for 30 days or not. But the other thing you can do to get an idea of what people think about this software and what other reviews are is to do a search, a Google search, for example, for voice recognition software reviews. And you'll get several sources, but generally the people I know who've been dealing with this tend to prefer Dragon Naturally Speaking. I haven't been using the software, so I can't address it directly. I'm just sort of giving you the feel. And I think its retail price is about $150 or so.
Right.
That's a professional version. There's one that's, I think, cheaper, and I don't know quite what the difference between them is, but you could certainly find that online.
Okay, well, that's good advice to check the reviews first.
Okay,
great. Thanks a lot.
And good luck.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking about computers this afternoon. It's a topic we take up once a month, usually on the third Monday of the month. Peter Kimball is our guest. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take another call, a listener on line two. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah,
yes.
Go ahead.
Thanks for the program. I tuned in late, so maybe you covered this, but I had a question concerning video teleconferencing using a PC-based platform as opposed to the Mac-based, which nowadays I gather has that already built in. My understanding is that there has been a software package called Skype, and now even Google has something, and I was wondering in these latter cases if you had any guidance about the efficiency of those type programs or their stability, things of that nature.
Well, the basic Skype software did not involve video. It was simply a way of making telephone calls over the internet. The video component of that is something I don't have a lot of experience with. There are all sorts of software packages for Windows machines out there. And so all I could really suggest would be, again, sort of as I mentioned to the last caller, do a search for video conferencing software reviews. If you're really wanting video conferencing, or are you wanting to just have two-way conversations?
Two-way conversations, okay. And possibly video, if at all
right.
possible.
Well, certainly internet telephony with programs like Skype and others is very stable and is very affordable. So that's well established, and there are many other programs other than Skype that will do that. And the video aspect of that is certainly going to demand a bit more of your bandwidth. You would not be very happy doing it on a dial-up connection, although you can deal with dial-up connections with just voice. But if you've got a broadband connection, I would simply do a review, a search for the various reviews for video conferencing software. Several of them are even free or shareware, so you can download them, see if you like them, and then if you don't, dump them.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. You're welcome.
Bye.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking about computers this afternoon. It's a topic we take up once a month, usually on the third Monday of the month. Peter Kimball is our guest. He is Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, no one waiting at the moment to talk with Peter, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We had a caller who mentioned voice recognition.
Yes.
And apparently one of the things that's on the horizon is gesture recognition.
Gesture and facial expressions, but the gesturing is certainly going to be on its way. Anybody who has dealt, for example, with the Wii knows about making gestures.
Sure.
And bowling and, you know, boxing and whatever else it is. But that's certainly something that has got a lot of potential, and we'll see. I think that's one of these official 15 hot new technologies that the latest set of predictions that I was just looking at have to deal with. One of the next big things. Yes.
Is there something else you wanted to mention, Peter, before another call?
I was just going to mention briefly, talking about all of these communications and with Skype on the telephone, one of the things, if we have time, we may talk about sometime. Everybody assumes that they've got email now and they just use email. It's almost like second nature for the vast majority of people. And Google has introduced a new program called Mail Goggles, which is designed to help you not send email late at night or when you're all upset that you'll regret later. I'm sure nobody's ever done that.
No.
and so what it does is you can set this with your Gmail account, and especially if you've been out to a party or something, you come back and say, I'm going to write that email, and you would think better of it the next morning. It asks you a series of fairly simple math questions, and if you can manage to do them in a minute or so, it'll let you write the email. Otherwise, it'll say, no. Come back later.
Yeah.
If you can't think clearly enough about this to do the math, you're not thinking clearly enough to send email.
And Mail Goggles gets its name from?
From beer goggles. Originally anecdotal observation that after a beer or two, people generally look more attractive or are rated more attractive. But that, in Great Britain, fairly recently, has actually been in a double-blind study confirmed as an effect. And it's not just for the opposite sex, it's for the same sex. They had people look at various photos, rate them, and then a little bit later rate them again. Control group, no alcohol. Those had a couple of beers. And it persisted, actually, for some time.
Yeah, apparently everything looks better after a beer or two.
Yeah. I guess so.
The bar.
Yeah.
The lighting. The music sounds better.
Yep, that's it.
So let's take another call.
The food tastes better, too.
No doubt. Let's take another call. Listener on line one, good afternoon. Line one, we got a caller there.
Are you there?
Yeah,
yes,
here we go.
Here.
I'm glad I had a couple of beers before I called. This will be a better conversation.
Good.
My son wants to get a laptop. He's 17. And he seems to think that buying an Apple means that he's going to have less people trying to hack him and be able to put in all this shareware and all these Trojans. And I'm trying to decide whether, you know, it seems like you pay twice as much for the same Apple as you do for a PC. laptop. What are the trade-offs and what are your feelings? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Well, you're correct in your observation that for a laptop of given power and given capabilities, you'll definitely pay a premium. It might not be twice as much, but it's typically 50% more than for an equivalent on the Windows side of things. As far as the safety versus all the various viruses and such, it's also certainly true that many, many more viruses and other malicious software is written targeting the Windows platform than for the Macintosh platform because there are a lot more Windows machines out there. However, that does not make the Macintosh immune to this, especially to the the drive-by clicking. If you click on inappropriate websites, there are websites that can attack the Mac not only by going to the Macintosh operating system, not as many of those, but to some of the applications. So it's necessary to keep that up to date on either the Windows or the Mac side. Adobe Acrobat, for example, very commonly used to read PDF files. Adobe just recently released a patch that will avoid certain security risks, and that's something that would need to be installed on both the Windows and the Macintosh side. So I guess the bottom line would be there is probably going to be less of a risk with the Apple Macintosh. However, with proper antivirus software and not going to places and clicking on pop-ups that say, click here, we've detected a virus on your machine, click here and we'll fix it, that could be a problem on both platforms. As long as you avoid that kind of behavior and are relatively cautious about clicking on unwanted or unexpected emails on either platform, I would say that you could go along safely on either side. I've got a son who's in college. He's got both a Windows and a Macintosh laptop. Don't ask me how that got started. And he spends more time on the Windows machine because we were able to get a much more powerful one there than the Mac. He just needed the Mac for a couple of bits of software.
Okay. Let's go and take another call. A listener on line 4. Good afternoon.
Oh, thank you very much. If someone has gotten a machine with Vista on it and has risen to an extremely high level of frustration in dealing with Vista compared with the comfort of XP, how advisable, inadvisable, difficult, easy, etc., is it, assuming you have a legitimate copy of XP, to uninstall Vista and install XP on the machine?
The best way of doing that, if it's a relatively new machine from one of the companies such as Odell or Hewlett-Packard, they can assist. It's often easier to get their assistance if it's a fairly new machine still under warranty. The difficulty you may have is not so much in installing XP. You could certainly, in the extreme case, simply reformat it all and just install XP and it'd be up and running. The difficulty is going to be making sure that you have the appropriate software drivers for your machine for XP. And we're not just talking about add-on drivers because you added this piece of hardware. There are several of these little software drivers, the software that acts as the go-between between the operating system, be it Vista or Windows XP, and all the various devices that are built into the computer, such as the network connection, such as the screen, such as the keyboard, even such as the CPU. And those drivers need to be written specifically for Vista or for Windows XP. And it's possible, if it's a newer machine, that you may have to spend a bit of time looking for the appropriate drivers to make the machine fully functional with Windows XP once you've installed it. We did the same thing to a number of machines in our lab, one of our training labs. And once we had installed XP, there were several aspects, about 5 or 6 different drivers that we had to download. Fortunately, we had checked on this and found out where they were in order for the machines to be fully functional. So the answer is it's not completely trivial, but especially with a bit of advice, and if you can and have support, call, especially if the machine is new enough, call the company and say, I want to downgrade this. Can you assist me? Can you tell me where the drivers are that I need?
Okay, well, in this case, it is within the year's warranty on the laptop.
Okay.
And I was going to ask if, since it's, well, if it's a fairly common problem, is there a site or the possibility of Googling something that would lead you more directly to the drivers that would need to be downloaded and where from?
Well, it's possible, although... Yes, I'm sorry. It is possible that there are some sites, but there are some differences. For example, let's say it's Dell, just to use them as an example.
Mm-hmm.
There are some specific ways Dell has designed their main circuit board, the motherboard, and that laptop, and the drivers may well be available from other sites, but may also be difficult to find other than from Dell's site, and that's sometimes a little bit hard to find. There is unfortunately no single clearinghouse, although you could certainly search for such, and there are a number of places with drivers out there, but... if you have the opportunity to talk to somebody at Dell about this, if it were a Dell computer, again, I'm using that example, then they could probably point you directly to their site and say, yes, this is where you need to go. That is a recognized need by a lot of people who buy these new machines with Vista on it. And at this point still, the major companies, Dell, HP, and many of the rest, are supporting that with drivers and such.
Okay, I hope that helps. Let's go and take another call now. A listener on line 2, I do believe, is where we're going next.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
My son just got a new laptop computer from a relative, and I have a desktop with Comcast. And his laptop is hooked up for wireless. Now, I plugged in my cable, but his laptop wouldn't work now. What do I need to do to make it work?
Okay, so you have a internet connection, a cable modem from through Comcast.
That's correct.
And you do not have wireless access currently. You just have a cable currently that just goes from your modem to your desktop machine.
That's correct.
And then when you unplug that and plug it into the laptop, it doesn't recognize it.
That's correct.
Generally, now, is this going to be a situation where you want to fairly frequently have both machines able to access the internet at the same time, or is the laptop going to go off and be off at college or something?
Well, they're probably down the road would probably be having both work at the same time, but at the present, I just was curious how his laptop would work, you know, I'm like hooked to Comcast, you know.
Well, the problem is apparently, and I've avoided this problem in most of the installations I've worked with by installing essentially a wireless router. They're now about $50 or so, so that you don't have to disconnect the modem, the cable modem from any devices. It just plugs into this router, which can either have several connections on the back to connect in a wired fashion, or, of course, because it's also a wireless router, allows you to connect wirelessly if you've got a laptop that will do that. The Comcast modem may well be expecting a certain address, a certain device, and it's called the MAC address, even though it's not has nothing to do with Macintosh. And when it doesn't get that, it may be necessary to reset that modem so that it will sort of look around and say, oh, what kind of a machine is connecting to me? But that would be a kind of inconvenient thing to do, because then you would have to reset it so it would be able to talk again to the desktop machine. You could do that. There is a procedure for resetting it. It's probably available at the Comcast site or from Comcast. You know, there's either a reset, a little button that you can press, or a place where you can push in a little hole where you can reset it, or you hold down, depending on the modem, you hold down a couple of the buttons at the same time. But better and more convenient, if it's not just a one-time thing, would be to look into getting a little wireless access point so that not only would you be able to connect both machines, but the laptop could be used from other places than just where the modem is located.
Now, is it because I would want that to be secure, Red, because I do trade some stock and commodities on the internet?
Yes. In fact, it will be secure. You'll want to make sure that when it's installed, you don't leave the wireless open for anybody to surf and who happens to be driving by to connect to. But that's pretty well described in the setup procedures. and the newer versions of security are pretty secure, for your desktop machine actually being plugged into the wireless access point, it will actually be a little bit more secure, all things considered, than just plugged into the modem, because there is it's essentially a second local network that you're on, and nobody else is on that network except for the machines that you've got connected to your wireless access point. When you're plugged directly into the modem, in essence, everybody in the neighborhood is on the same node and could be checking, you know, watching the packets go by, although generally when you're doing your stock trading, you're always connected with a secure connection. You've got the little padlock icon or the HTTPS address, so you're probably secure anyway, but even slightly more secure with a wireless access point. It's just it's a physical hardware barrier that's between you and people who might just be scanning for an address.
Okay, I hope that helps. And we're going to see if we can get a couple more callers in here before we're out of time. We go next to line 3. Good afternoon.
Yes, I'll try to make this quick. I've got a laptop, and what I want to do is back up my information, such as QuickBooks and so on. And I bought a Western Digital 320 gig hard drive, and there really wasn't any instructions or anything that came with the thing. You just plug it in, and then finally, a few days later, a screen popped up, and I kind of went through it, and I guess I backed stuff up. But it seems like I've lost a lot of space on my computer. Is it possible I could have backed everything up to my own hard drive? I know it sounds like a silly question, but is that a possibility?
So this was one of the those external Western Digital drives, like the MyBook or something?
Yes. They told me I needed, you know, I was using a memory stick, and I was afraid I'd lose all my photos, and I wanted to back up more than QuickBooks.
Well, those and your the laptop is a Windows machine, or okay. The Western Digital external drives come with their own backup software, and they just start running, and they're fairly convenient, although a lot of that backup software, I think the one that at least used to be bundled with the Western Digital external drives, was sort of on a trial basis, and you could go ahead and purchase it if you wanted to continue using it. The other thing you can do, and it's certainly possible that the configuration kept track of what files you've got on your local hard drive, which of course is fine if you've got a lot of space, but not in your case. You'll want to make sure, and you can just find the documentation online probably for this device, and look at what it actually has backed up. The other possibility, and what I've done with a number of cases, is just decide not to use that backup software and just to use it as an external hard drive, and just because the entire external hard drive would hold everything that's on my machine, I just copy the whole thing over there. So, yes, it is certainly possible that it has kept track of various tables and the status of various files. It probably did not make a backup of everything on your laptop's hard drive, but it certainly had to add its own software, and that was done when you just plugged the thing in.
Okay, I hope that helps. And we've got one last caller here, so let's go and take this call. Line 1, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I am not a highly sophisticated user of the computer, but I do word processing and so on, and I have Vista on my computer. And in the last few months, I found every time I shut down Microsoft, when I'm doing a document in Microsoft Office, and I shut down, I get this complicated message saying it stopped working, checking for a solution. Then it tells me it's going to restart and to ask for permission to restart. And then it says there is a problem with my Hewlett-Packard printer and that they're working on the problem. And then it will restart eventually. But I go through this routine every single time I try to shut down a Word document. And today I got the message that they found a temporary workaround available, and again they're saying Hewlett-Packard is aware of the problem, is working on a solution, and so my choice is either to change my printer or to find another printer.
And we've got 1 minute to solve
okay.
this one.
Well, 1 minute. So what you can do is only – you can change your default printer to just one of the Windows virtual devices. There, you'll find a couple of things when you choose a printer. Certainly you can't print to it, but I would do that, set that as my default printer, see if that solves the problem. You could always then change that when you actually need to print. I'm going to guess that this happens just when you shut off Word. When you save the document but don't print, then if the same thing happens, you might want to consider doing a search for that same problem. If indeed Hewlett-Packard is aware of it and you're getting messages to that effect, there are probably other people in the same situation. And so a Google search with Vista, the model of your printer, and Microsoft Word should give you some idea of the solutions. But you could also temporarily point your word processing program to another, maybe even non-physical printer, and avoid that annoying message.
Okay, very good. We're out of time. Boy, we took a lot of traffic today. Thank
yes.
you very much, Peter. And I think we'll see you again next
yes,
month in
it'll
December.
Yes, it'll be in December 3rd Monday, whenever that is.
Okay, very good. Peter Kimball is the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. He joins us once a month for our Computers and You show. Generally, we do it on the third Monday of the month, once a month here on the Afternoon Magazine.